afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. We have a weighty topic for you today, yet again. Merry Christmas, almost.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We always wind up talking about serious things. I had someone email me and say it was too depressing. Like, we try to have fun while we're doing it so that it's not too depressing.
We try to cover the whole story.
At the very least, we have experts. Hooray. So you're not listening to us go on and on about...
Us professional talking heads.
Yeah, right. Keep our day jobs. Okay. So today, as I'm sure those of you who listened last week will remember, we had Claire Lopez on. And the last 15, 20 minutes, we got talking about the EMP Commission. That really, I don't know, I'm assuming most people didn't know anything about, and we found out it had been disbanded, and then we ran out of time.
Yeah.
So.
And that's really a important thing, I think.
Yeah.
We need to know more about that.
So Dr. Peter Vincent Pry served on the EMP Commission. He was the executive director for the commission, and he is, I'll just give you his bio, and then you'll have to read the rest. It's very long.
And, for those who don't know, EMP means?
Oh, electromagnetic pulse. Well, he's going to tell us all about that. Okay. That's the, I was an English major. I was not a science major. so I'm going to stop there.
Well, I was an acronym major.
I know it makes the computers and everything go crazy, and I was having a little problem on that today. I can't scroll my screen. All I can see is this bio, thank goodness, the one page it got stuck on. So Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security and Director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum, both Congressional Advisory Boards. He served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House and Armed Services Committee, and the CIA, just to throw in for good measure. He has authored Apocalypse Unknown, The Struggle to Protect America from an Electromagnetic Pulse Catastrophe, and Electric Armageddon. That's kind of got all the scary words in that title. And both are available from createspace.com and amazon.com. We have the links right there on the page. Our page is wethepeopleradio.us.
Along with other really good reads down there at the bottom.
Yeah, we've got both his articles, the one on Korea that I can't see the title of because my screen won't scroll. And I'm sure we'll get to all of that because we have him for the full show today. And I'm sure we'll run out of time.
As usual.
So the one thing I forgot to do, I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
So there, you can identify the voices. And Dr. Peter Pry is with us. So where would you like to start?
Well, perhaps we could start by defining what an electromagnetic pulse is for those in the audience who may not know about it.
For all the rest of the non-science people.
Yeah. An electromagnetic pulse, one should know about this because it actually constitutes the greatest threat to the United States and really to the existence of Western civilization. You know, both because it's such an overwhelming threat, and at the same time, because even though, despite the best efforts of the EMP Commission for 17 years to educate the general public and policymakers, it is still little known and little understood. In effect, to understand an EMP, going to Physics 101, an electromagnetic pulse is caused by a magnetic field set in motion. Magnetic field in motion will cause an EMP. And in effect, one way of thinking about an EMP is, you know, imagine a super energetic radio wave that's got so much energy in it that while it will pass harmlessly through people's bodies, it will destroy all the electronics with which it comes into contact with. So airplanes flying through the sky would have electronics in them destroyed, and the plane might crash. Automobiles might stop running because the electronics of the automobile engine will fail. The electric power grid, you know, would be destroyed. And we're not talking about a temporary blackout. We're talking about a protracted blackout from which the power grid, frankly, might never recover because... the commission on which I served estimated that if we had a nationwide blackout that lasted 1 year, up to 90% of our population would die. Starvation, disease, societal collapse. So there'd be no coming back from that. And that's because we're an electronic civilization. We depend upon electricity and electronics to support not just our modern economy, but support our very lives. you know, immediately. There's no pure running water without electricity. You know, food, even the supplying food, depends directly or indirectly upon electricity. All the necessities of life. Now, since we've got 2 hours, let me take the rare opportunity I have here to get into a little more depth to explain what an EMP is. And you can stop me if this is getting too pedantic and boring, okay?
Oh, yeah, if we've heard it already, you mean?
Well, if just kidding. People aren't interested in hearing it. If you understand how a lawnmower works, you know, you don't need a degree in physics to understand EMP, all right? In effect, when you start your lawnmower, you pull on a cord and you spin a cluster of magnets called a magneto, and that causes a magnetic field to move. And this moving magnetic field stimulates the movement of electrons in a coil that surrounds the magneto, and it actually creates a small electromagnetic pulse in the heart of your lawnmower that you can see in the form of a spark that sparks your spark plug. Now, the Earth is a giant magnet, and it's surrounded by a magnetic field that we call the magnetosphere. And if the Sun hurls a solar flare, technically it's called a coronal mass ejection, traveling millions of miles of Earth, a great blob of the Sun gets hurled out of itself, out of the sunspots, comes at the Earth traveling a million miles an hour or more, it encounters the magnetosphere, which over the millennia, over billions of years, has saved all life on Earth. Because if we weren't surrounded by a magnetic field, this ionized mass of plasma would destroy all life on Earth. But it doesn't. But what it does do, because the magnetosphere holds it off, so the coronal mass ejection flows around the magnetosphere and out into space harmlessly as far as life is concerned. But in the process of saving us, the magnetosphere gets deformed, it distorted, it wobbles around. And this will cause geomagnetic storms, a form of natural EMP, which will destroy electronics on Earth. And magnetic storms happen exactly this way all the time. Every year there are magnetic storms that happen, call them geomagnetic storms. But they're usually isolated to countries at high northern latitudes, you know, Canada, Finland, Sweden, Russia. Every now and again, we have experienced in our own lifetimes a significant one. It was called the 1989 Hydro-Quebec storm, and it blacked out half of Canada in 90 seconds. But it didn't, it only lasted a day. It only killed a few people and, caused, you know, maybe $1 billion worth of damage. It wasn't a civilization-ending experience because it wasn't the thing we're most afraid of in terms of natural EMP, which is the rare, once every century or so, geomagnetic superstorm, like the 1859 Carrington event, which is the most powerful geomagnetic storm known to us on record. But we've only been keeping records since 1859, you know. And man hasn't been an electronic civilization until later, the last two-thirds of the 20th century.
Was there any negative effect from that 1859 event?
It was. There was. Because electronics was just in their infancy, and telegraph systems were deployed all over the world. Wherever the colonial powers built a railroad, and they had built railroads in Africa, India, and China, and all the major continents, they would string a telegraph system alongside it. And the telegraph systems all over the world failed. We had just laid the transatlantic cable in 1859, connecting the United States to Europe. And the pulse from the Carrington event was so powerful, it reached miles deep into the Atlantic Ocean, burned out the cable, and it had to be replaced.
Wow.
Fires broke out in telegraph stations. If you have ever seen a telegraph key, I've got one sitting on my desk. Those telegraph keys in 1859, you know, they're not microchips. You know, they're big, bulky, heavy pieces of metal. And telegraph keys melted cables. The telegraph cables burst into flame and caused forest fires all over the world. The pulse was so powerful, it caused an extraordinarily bright. You would know if it was a geomagnetic superstorm versus a run-of-the-mill geomagnetic storm because of the brightness of the aurora borealis. The aurora borealis, and because it would be seen almost everywhere in the world. you know, the aurora borealis is usually confined to high northern latitudes, but in 1859 it was seen everywhere, including on the equator over the Hawaiian Islands, and it was so bright that you could read newspapers at night by the light of the aurora borealis in London.
Wow.
So you'll know if we get hit, you know, because of that extraordinarily bright and everywhere present aurora borealis. And that's what we're concerned about. One of the threats from EMP that we're concerned about is the natural EMP threat that could affect global civilization. And we're overdue for another Carrington event. You know, we estimate they happen every century or so. We're about 50 years overdue. I mean, you know, 1859 is more than 100 years ago. So we're more than 50 years overdue. We were narrowly missed a few years ago. I think it was in 2012 that we were missed by 3 days. An aurora borealis, a coronal mass ejection, a Carrington class coronal mass ejection crossed the path of the Earth and missed us by just 3 days. And had it hit us, it would basically have threatened billions of lives. It would have collapsed electric grids and electronic systems all over the world and put billions of lives at risk all over the world. NASA estimates the likelihood of the recurrence of a Carrington-class geomagnetic superstorm is 12% per decade, which virtually guarantees that within our lifetimes or that of our grandchildren, you know, we will experience this. And it's going to happen 100% for sure. It's just a question of when. And by the laws of probability, it'll be in the next one, two, or no further off than the third generation, our grandchildren's generation.
Wow.
No later than that.
On that scary note, we have to take a really quick break, and then we're going to come back and, wow, I didn't know we missed something like that by 3 days.
Yeah, if something like that, when something like that happens, what can we expect? What types of damage would that do in today's society? Let's hit that when we come back.
Squashed by a giant. You're listening to We the People. Our guest is Dr. Peter Pry. We'll be right back.
When they move into your neighborhood, they take over but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Say, you learned your lesson
all the way. Forgot about that, the old Western Union song. Well, our guest today is Dr. Peter Pry. He served as the Chief of Staff to the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission. And so we're talking about EMPs today, all factual. And I just happened to look at my news update while we were on break there. Power outage at the Atlanta airport causes pandemonium in grounds flights. That was this morning a few hours ago.
There you go.
Little power outage, and it messes grounded up the entire city of Atlanta. So,
Peter, what types of things can people expect to see if a natural EMP were to occur? And my other question was, if these natural ones, we can predict them, we know they're going to hit us. If we turn everything off, I know the grid is going to get fried. But as far as your own personal electronic devices, if you turn everything off, this thing passes, can you turn them back on and, say, run off a generator, or are they done?
Well, for the natural EMP, you don't have to worry about turning off small electronic devices. You don't have to worry about your automobile or airplanes flying through the sky, because the natural EMP doesn't do damage as deeply. It's different from the nuclear EMP, which is far more damaging. That's because the wavelength for a natural EMP is very large. It's on the order of a kilometer. So anything that has a dimension that's less than that basically doesn't get affected by it. It needs great big targets like the electric grid, communications, telephone lines, railroad tracks. It'll couple into railroad tracks, pipelines, things like that. but an automobile is too small. Your personal computer is too small. And your personal computer will be survived even without your turning it off. The problem is that the natural EMP will destroy the electric grid. And, because the electric grid is not protected against it. It'll melt big extra high voltage transformers. For example, in Canada, the 1989 Hydro-Quebec storm, which was not a superstorm, okay? It was a more powerful run-of-the-mill kind of storm. But it melted BHV transformers, that's extra high voltage transformers that are designed to carry 750,000 volts. It melted them in 90 seconds, okay? And you can't come back from that. If we lost large numbers of BHV transformers, fortunately it didn't destroy large numbers in 1989. But it did destroy an EHV transformer and a nuclear reactor in New Jersey. And, you know, the coils were actually melted. Yeah. So you can just imagine the power, and that's from a run-of-the-mill type storm. These EHV transformers there are two things that are to our civilization what aqueducts and roads were to the Roman civilization, the classical world. You know, you couldn't support the Roman Empire and Roman civilization without aqueducts and roads. And our modern electronic civilization can't survive without EHV transformers and SCADAs, because they are what makes everything work, particularly in the electric grid. These EHV transformers are bigger than a house. They weigh hundreds of tons. There's only 2,000 of them in the United States, all right? But if we lost a substantial fraction of them, you know, we would not be able to replace them. They're not even made in America anymore. This is one of the ironies. We invented the electric grid here in the United States. Nikola Tesla invented it at the turn of the century, and we exported the technology for electric grids to the whole world, and in effect brought the world into the electronic age. But like so many things, we don't make that technology in America anymore. We have to import our own EHV transformers now from South Korea and Germany, and they have to be custom-made. You can't mass-produce them. The windings are done by hand, because every EHV transformer plays a slightly different role in the grid, and you can't place them on a mass-produced basis. Each one has to be custom-made, and it takes 18 months to build just one of them.
Wow.
In fact, the worldwide production of EHV transformers, the entire world can only make less than 200 EHV transformers a year. And so you can do the math yourself. You know, we've got 2,000 EHV transformers. If a geomagnetic superstorm destroyed 2,000 of them, well, it would take 10 years to replace all 2,000, even if the entire world was willing to dedicate its entire productivity of EHV transformers just to the United States.
So,
and, of course, 10 years, we don't have 10 years because we'll lose 90% of our population in one year.
Right. So when you say 2,000, that's 2,000 of these transformers that are actually online right now.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And just as important as them is something that's on the other end of the scale in terms of size, and they're called SCADAs, Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Systems. When I was a kid, when I was in the 1970s, 1960s, we had hundreds of thousands of blue-collar technical workers running the electric grid, running with the waterworks, running gas pipelines, you know, running all of the basic utilities that we take for granted. There would be guys who would sit there and watch the flow of water, the flow of electricity through a gauge, regulate it, all right? And they would know how to, being technically trained. If something went wrong, they would be able to go out and fix it, do the workarounds. And all of these people were replaced in the 1970s during the microelectronics revolution by what we call SCADA, Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Systems. They're little computers about the size of your personal computer, and they're everywhere. There's millions of them, and they run everything now. So you can run a whole city with a dozen people or fewer than a dozen people from a control center. But as long as the SCADAs work. But if the SCADAs are destroyed or something goes wrong with them in large numbers, then we're in trouble. I mean, the SCADAs were designed by geniuses basically to be used by idiots, you know? and if we lose the SCADAs, that's just as bad as losing those EHV transformers. You know, the people, there are not enough people working in the utilities to replace them. And there are so many of them, they're so numerous, that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to replace them in large numbers if they were destroyed by a nuclear EMP. It would require a nuclear EMP, though, to destroy the SCADAs. They would, but they would go out when the grid goes black. And, so those are some of the hazards. Perhaps I should just talk you through, we started with the natural EMP, but maybe I can give you a little timeline of what to expect. I mean, immediately, there would be no running water because it requires, hundreds of millions of volts to purify and pump running water to our major metropolitan areas. In 3 days, most places now only have emergency power, only enough fuel on site to support 3 days of emergency power at hospitals, police stations, airports. So in 3 days, the emergency generating power would fail in most of the major public, utilities or emergency systems. And this would include big regional food warehouses that we need. We only have enough food in grocery stores to feed the local population for about 3 days normal consumption rates, and then it has to be resupplied from these big regional food warehouses, and their emergency generators only last 3 days too. And so the food would then begin to spoil in 3 days. And even if it didn't, we only have 30 days enough food in the country to feed the population of 320 million people for 30 days. But the food won't last 30 days. It will begin to spoil in 3. Then in 7 days, we've got 100 nuclear reactors in this country. And if the grid is out for 7 days, those 100 nuclear reactors, their emergency batteries will fail. That's their last resource for cooling the cooling ponds where the nuclear fuel rods are, for cooling the reactor cores. So in 7 days, with no emergency power to circulate water anymore, they would go Fukushima, and you would have radioactivity spread, throughout the country. And basically, it then becomes a clock ticking toward, the starvation of 320 million people plus society falling into chaos. Because we also know that 24 hours after the lights go out from things like hurricanes and tornadoes, the worst elements of society emerge. And, law enforcement tends to fail, especially when they don't have communications. You won't be able to get, even though your car would run after a geomagnetic superstorm, it won't run without gasoline. And, there won't be any gas in gas stations. There won't be natural gas coming in anymore to run power plants or to heat your home. So that's the situation with a natural EMP.
Now, before we go to the nuclear one.
Wait, hold on. Guys, we've got a million questions, but we have to take a really quick break, or we're going to be totally screwed up here.
Okay, cliffhanger time.
Really quick break, and then we'll come back. Have to absorb this momentarily. We are chatting with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and if you're not worried already, you will be soon. Sorry to be so stressful the week before Christmas, but this is really important, and I think a lot more people need to understand how this works. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People.
I'll be right back.
Sunshine came softly through my window today. Could have tripped out DC, but I've changed my ways. Take time, I know it, but in a while, you're gonna be mine, I know it, we'll do it in style, cause I've made my mind up, you're going to be mine, I'll tell you right now, any trick in a book and a paper.
Just like Adam and Eve.
shape to the sky. I've never been so high.
So
if they do drop the bomb on us, it will be like Adam and Eve.
So I have one question, Peter, before we moved on to the nuclear part of this thing. In the event of a coronal mass ejection, how much time would we have before it actually hit the Earth?
Yes, thank you for raising that question. It occurred to me that I had forgotten to answer it, and I was going to go back to answer that. It depends on the nature of the coronal mass ejection. It takes a normal coronal mass ejection, the kind that hits us every year that causes these things like a Hydro-Quebec storm. It takes about 3 days. 3 days for the CME to cross the 97 million miles from the sun to the Earth. But the Carrington event in 1859 was much faster than that because it was much more energetic. So it only took 11 hours.
Wow.
But that doesn't mean we've got 11 hours or 3 days of early warning, which is one of the things that NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, and those who try to give false reassurance that they're on top of this, they can deal with this. You know, one of NERC's arguments has been that, well, we'll see the coronal mass coming and we'll be able to turn off the grid to protect it, which is not a guarantee it would survive. When you turn electronics off, it does increase the chances that they'll survive, but it's no guarantee. You know, the only guarantee of protecting electronics is hardening them, you know, so that you know they're protected. Now, the reason we don't have 3 days or 11 hours is because it matters what the charge is on the coronal mass ejection. It can have a positive or a negative charge. If it's got a positive charge, we're going to be okay because it won't couple well with the magnetosphere, and then basically there won't be a storm. However, it's got a negative charge, it will couple with the magnetosphere. And we can't tell what the charge is on the coronal mass ejection until it's about 15 minutes out from Earth.
That's
because
great.
We used to have a satellite called the ACE satellite. It's out in deep space. It's about 25,000 miles out. And that's about 15 minutes in terms of the speed that the CME travels. And that will tell us what the charge is, whether it's positive or negative. Now, the ACE got old, and they replaced it with another old satellite called the Discovery satellite, which unfortunately was never really specifically designed for this purpose. People call it the Al Gore satellite because it was actually built many years ago, about 20 years ago, for climate change research. And it's been sitting in a warehouse. And what they did is they added a sensor to it, so that in addition to climate change research, it will also have a sensor that can tell us what the charge is on the coronal mass ejection. And so they shot that out to replace the ACE satellite. I think that was a bad idea. I think it's always a bad idea. Even though it's been sitting in a warehouse, it's really old. And, you know, you want to know on such an important matter as this.
Yeah.
You want to know absolutely positively for sure if you're getting the right data, if it's right. That's why we couldn't rely on the ACE satellite anymore. It got so old, it started giving false readings. And I'm not sure the Discovery satellite, given how old it is going to be that much of an improvement. You know, we should put out a new satellite dedicated to this purpose. It's such an important thing. The other issue about, you know, this idea about turning off the grid, and I would be in favor of that, okay, if we did have a warning enough time, but you've only got 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I think politically, I find it impossible to imagine that NERC, that the North America would, and the rest of the countries of the world for that matter, suppose they saw a big coronal mass ejection coming, and they didn't know what the charge was on it yet, but we knew that because of its speed and its size, that it was going to be something like the Carrington event, and that it was probably going to hit us. Still, there's a 50-50 chance that it might not do anything because we don't know what the charge is. Under those circumstances, would the whole world really shut down their electric grids? I mean, people are going to die when you do that. There's all kinds of negative consequences. You're going to have to leave the grid off for a couple of days, okay, so that the whole world would be without electricity for days. There are things that happen to nuclear reactors, the food. You know, there's a big price to be paid, and it would, and the price would probably include the loss of sacrificing, you know, thousands of lives, people that are on life support and on various kinds of situations. And it also seems to me that, you know, that given the behavior of the utilities in the past, they're not going to take that responsibility. They don't want to be sued. It would have to be a decision the world leaders, like the president, would have to make a decision about whether to shut down the grid. And when you tell Mr. President, well, it's possible that nothing might happen because we don't know what the charge is, isn't the president going to want to wait and know for sure what the charge is on that thing to find out? Well, if he does that, he's only got 15 minutes. You know,
this is like one of those really bad movies that you think is fake, but actually there's a version of this really scary movie that's real.
Yeah, and 15 minutes, is that even enough time to shut it down at that point?
It isn't enough time. It isn't enough time. Look at our. I like to use the analogy of our Minuteman ICBM launch crews, okay? They are highly disciplined. They exercise for launching Minuteman missiles in 20 minutes or less all the time. There's a command and control infrastructure set up, ballistic missile early warning radars, satellite radars, emergency communications. And our guys need 20 to 15 minutes early warning to be able to launch those missiles, okay? They can barely do it, but they wouldn't be able to do it if all they had was 15 minutes warning. So why should we expect the utilities to be able to do that? They don't have anything like the command and control. There's 3,000 different utilities. It's not like there's only one big utility, and there is no protocols, no command and control system, not even a legal protocol set up where the president could get on the pick up a red telephone and suddenly have all these guys. We've never even practiced a nationwide shutdown of the electric grid. I mean, it's just ridiculous to think we could even do that. Yeah. We're not even prepared to do it. And if we did do it, it wouldn't be any kind of a guarantee that it would solve the problem.
That's not an option.
That's the early warning we have. You know, we do have, in the case of a normal geomagnetic storm, we've got about 3 days. Of course, if it's a superstorm, it could be as little as 11 hours or less. And we don't, but that doesn't translate into how much early warning. We've really got only 15 minutes of early warning because I don't think anything is going to be done until the coronal mass ejection touches the A satellite so that we'll know what the charge is on the coronal mass ejection.
So I guess this begs the question, we've had an EMP commission, and when was that started?
2001.
Wow.
And it was preceded by 5 years of congressional hearings on EMP to do due diligence to find out, well, are we doing anything about EMP? Who knows about it? Is the intelligence community following into this? The Department of Defense? So there were 5 years of congressional hearings that I ran before we had the EMP commission that began in 2001, and the commission was on and off for 17 years until this year when it was closed in the end of September. And ironically, in the very month that North Korea tested a hydrogen bomb, which it described as being capable of a super powerful EMP attack, and then a couple days later, North Korea released a technical report called the EMP Might of Nuclear Weapons, accurately describing a super EMP weapon. And then Washington, in its wisdom, decided to close down the EMP commission.
And what was the thought process behind that? I guess I'm using the term thought process loosely.
Yes, right. Well, it's complicated. It's a case of killing the messenger, you know. I mean, it happens in Washington all the time. You know, when you don't like the message, you kill the messenger. And this isn't a phenomenon that's limited to Washington. I mean, it goes back to as old as history. I mean, Shakespeare's play, Henry II, will no one rid me of this troublesome priest? you know, we've been killing the messenger for quite a while. Who doesn't like the message? There's a lot of people. You have to remember, first of all, there aren't that many people that are experts on EMP. It's just a handful of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, people who are technical experts, people who are intelligence officers who have been following this, the military writings and the operational and the military plans of potential adversaries. So you've got a handful of scientists and intelligence officers and strategic thinkers who've known about EMP all through the Cold War. Not many of us, a handful of us, okay? We do have the facts on our side, and that's always helpful, but it's not always enough to win the fight, the political fight. Because there are powerful interests against us, all right? For one thing, I've mentioned NERC. You know, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation doesn't want to do anything about EMP. Doesn't want to do anything about cyber warfare either, or physical sabotage against the grid.
But why is that? Yeah.
It costs them money. And it could entail additional government regulation. You know, somebody looking over their shoulder. Right now, the electric power industry is the last critical infrastructure that regulates itself. You know, there is no organization like the Federal Aviation Administration or the Pure Food and Drug Administration that has real substantial regulatory authority that can force them to do things. There should be, but there isn't. You know, the closest thing we've got is this thing called the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. But the FERC is just a bunch of lawyers who used to work for the electric power industry. This political scientists would call the phenomenon regulatory capture, where the agency that's supposed to be overseeing the electric power industry basically is in the pocket of the electric power industry. And they're just one actor, okay? But they don't want to do anything. I know that that's hard for people to believe, let me provide clarification right here and now. I'm not a big fan of big government or government regulation. I'm a Tea Party conservative, all right? A Jeffersonian type conservative who believes in small government and that government which governs best governs least. But even Thomas Jefferson, who was the, you know, ultimate libertarian, was not an anarchist. You know, Jefferson said, well, we do need government. We need government to provide for public safety and for the common defense, and that's what government is supposed to do. And the reason we need government to do that is because the private sector won't do it. You know, you can't rely on the private sector to take on the jobs of national security and homeland security and public safety. You've got to have government looking over their shoulders to do that. Now, I believe in the private, you know, free enterprise is the best, most ingenious system that's ever evolved for providing goods and services to people at the lowest cost. But their object is profit and doing things at the lowest cost. And as a consequence, if you don't have government to look over public safety, you will have things such as what happened in the 19th century. I mean, Coca-Cola, there was a time when Coca-Cola actually did have cocaine in it, all right?
Right.
And when, before there was a Pure Food and Drug Administration, thumbs would show up in people's cans of peaches and rancid meat would be sold to the public. Opium was in common drugs that could be bought by anybody. Addictions were very common. Look at the Zeppelin industry in the 1920s, all right? Here's a whole industry that convinced itself that it was safe to transport the flying public by hydrogen gas balloon, all right? Highly explosive gas. They could have bought helium for a little bit more, but they didn't want to do that. It would be more expensive. And they convinced themselves that through the genius of their operational procedures that they would never have a Hindenburg. But a Hindenburg did happen eventually, and it put the whole Zeppelin industry out of business. So, you know, the libertarian kind of argument is that, well, you can trust the private sector to, because it's in their long-term interest to stay in business. But no, that's not true. You know, we didn't have safety glass and seat belts and balloon, passenger balloons in automobiles until government required that. Bhopal, India, Union Carbide, when they were making pesticides in the United States, didn't want to spend the money on the government regulations to make them here in this country, to make pesticide manufacturing safe. So they went to Bhopal, India, you know, where they didn't have to obey those regulations. I understand the estimates that people are still dying from the pesticide accident that happened in Bhopal, hundreds of thousands of them. I think it's rivaling the casualties from the Hiroshima bomb, okay? Now, that's what happens when you just leave industry completely unfettered. And basically, NERC is in charge. This whole country is the Hindenburg. captained by the nerve, heading for a rendezvous with a geomagnetic superstorm or a North Korean EMP attack right now. And that is because even though these guys have children, okay, and they have grandchildren, they're also that's not their job. You know, their argument, NERC would say, if they were in this room right here, their argument would say, well, it's the job of the Department of Defense to protect the country from these things, not in the electric power industry. And you know what? They would be right. They would be right. It is the job of the Department of Defense and of the U.S. government. And that's why the government and the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense should be working together and telling NERC, you must protect the grid. And Congress should be passing laws that require them to pass the grid, and it should be they should be told how to do it. Maybe the government should even pay for it, and it should be inspected.
Well, this would be part of, national defense. I mean,
this is what the commission recommended, okay?
Yeah.
But we have other enemies aside from the NERC, all right? One of them being the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense doesn't want to be responsible for protecting the electric grid or helping protect the electric grid. They're really fearful of their monies being siphoned off to help protect the electric power grid. The Department of Defense kind of has forgotten that line in the Constitution about providing for the common defense. That's their purpose.
Right.
They think they provide for the common defense by being prepared to fight wars overseas. I mean, yeah, just like NERC does one thing really well, one of those things being protecting itself from government regulation, the Department of Defense over the years is not a philosopher that thinks deeply about, well, you know, protecting the American people and their homes actually should be job one. That's not how they think over there. They think job one is going over to Afghanistan to kill the Taliban. All right, that's job one for them.
Well, all of this seems very far. I'm sure, you know, well, it's not happening today. It's not happening right now. So we'll get to that later. Oh, my gosh.
That's true. Also,
we have to take one more quick break before the top of the hour here. Sorry, I hate to cut you off because we could just listen to you talk for another hour. Hey, that's coming. We are here with Peter Vincent Pry. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, actually, and we'll be chatting about EMPs. You're listening to We the People Radio. Find us on wethepeopleradio.us.
No place to hang out or washing, and then I can't blame all on the sun. Oh, no, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Oh, we're gonna rock down to Electric Avenue, and then we'll take.
You got me shaking, got me running away. You got me crawling up to you every day. Don't bring me down. No, 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 no. I tell you what, though, before I get off the floor, don't bring me down, down, down.
It's too late.
Bring me down, man.
It's too late. Okay. So Bill's got a million questions for you, Dr. Pry, but we're making him wait till after the top of the hour. Because I want to because I want to finish this part about the political side of it.
I get no respect.
Exactly.
We got to do that part, because how do we get back to a place where this becomes national security again?
Because that is the very problem. You've touched it with a needle, you see. There are so many people who think that solving the EMP problem is technical or it's a question of money. No, it isn't. We know how to protect against EMP, and it wouldn't even cost that much.
Oh.
The problem is political. It's the politics of EMP that's going to get us killed at the end of the day if we can't resolve the political problem. And it's the political problem that has stalled progress on this issue for 17 years. And so we talked about the problem from industry, from NERC. We talked about the Department of Defense, for example, its internal bureaucratic interests. A huge obstacle has been the holdovers from the Obama administration. You know, because for half the country that supported the Obama administration foreign policy, EMP is a politically incorrect threat, especially nuclear EMP attack.
Why?
Okay?
How does that happen?
Because of the Iran nuclear deal, and because of the situation in North Korea, and because of President Obama's foreign policy goal of a world without nuclear weapons. Let's start with this world without nuclear weapons claim. The left, to try to sell the idea that achieving a world without nuclear weapons was a good and realistic thing, tried very hard to make the case that nuclear weapons basically don't have any utility, that a primitive country like a North Korea and Iran, they could never compete with us, they couldn't really pose a serious threat with us, even if they started to get the bomb. And so if you accept that premise, then it starts to make a world without nuclear weapons sound like some kind of a negotiable, more achievable kind of a thing. But EMP is a huge contradiction to that worldview, because you don't need a sophisticated nuclear weapon. You only need one nuclear weapon to destroy a whole country, including the United States. And so even if you take, for example, the Iran nuclear deal, even if Iran was somehow clandestinely to build just one bomb, it would make the Iran nuclear deal worthless and a failure. And the verification requirements to ensure that Iran couldn't build even just one bomb would have to be much more stringent than what they had in the Iran nuclear deal, which has some of the worst verification provisions that have ever been conceived in any nuclear deal. So EMP threatened the idea of a world without nuclear weapons. It threatened the Iran nuclear deal. And Obama's claim, his dismissal of the North Korean nuclear threat all through his administration, is also belied by the EMP threat. Because, again, you don't even need a reentry vehicle. You know, you can detonate the weapon in outer space. North Korea was, people even now act like North Korea. They need a reentry vehicle to pose a threat to the mainland of the United States. Not true. The EMP Commission has been warning for years, including during the Obama administration, that they could already threaten the United States with an EMP attack. You only need one weapon. It doesn't need to be accurate. It doesn't need to be able to reenter the atmosphere. You don't even need an ICBM. You could deliver it off by a short-range ballistic missile launched off a freighter. Some kinds of cruise missiles that can be used. A airplane doing a zoom climb, even a meteorological balloon can get up above 30 kilometers to do a nuclear EMP attack. All of these things were possible for North Korea during the Obama years.
Hold that thought. That was the news that was trying to interrupt us. Darn news. We've got 5 minutes of news, so grab some coffee or whatever you like, and we'll be right back with Dr. Peter Vincent-Pryor. You're listening to We the People.
On KCNR, Shasta Redding.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio, or maybe we should call it Scary Sunday. It's turning into Scary Sunday. Well, this topic of EMPs is huge, and we need to get a lot smarter about this, because we need to figure out how to put some pressure to get this whole thing looked at and back online. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And we have our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, with us this afternoon, actually. I was going to say this morning, but it's actually afternoon. So I read you part of his bio earlier. I'm going to pick a different section. He served as the professional staff on the House Armed Services Committee of the U.S. Congress with portfolios in nuclear strategy, WMD, Russia, China, NATO, the Middle East, intelligence, and terrorism from 1995 to 2001. While serving on the House Armed Services, Dr. Pry was chief advisor to the vice chairman of the House Armed Services Committee and the vice chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, and to the chairman of the terrorism panel. Bottom line is, Dr. Pry is not making this stuff up. He didn't learn it in his basement. I don't even know if he has a basement. If he does, I hope he uses it. But he played a key role running hearings in Congress that warned terrorists and rogue states could pose EMP and cyber threats. Imagine that. Establishing the Congressional EMP Commission, helping the commission to develop plans to protect the United States from EMP and cyber warfare, and working closely with the senior scientists and the nation's top experts on critical infrastructures, EMP, and cyber warfare. And that's electromagnetic pulse is the EMP part. I think most people know that, but
well, there's a lot
never
of,
can tell.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk right now in the news about the North Korean threat and Rocket Man setting off all these nuclear weapons over there.
And I think everybody thinks, well, we'll just shoot it down once it gets up there. We'll be all good.
Shoot it down. But what you were just saying, Peter, about having the ability to launch one of these things from a freighter or whatever. I mean, we're talking flight time of probably less than a minute. How close would one of these nuclear missiles have to be to the United States to set off an EMP in our country big enough to shut our grid down?
All it has to do, you just have to get a warhead above an altitude of 30 kilometers. And now that won't cover the whole country, okay? But you don't have to cover the whole country. That's another misconception that's
right
out there, that the EMP field has to cover the whole country. Now, the North Koreans actually are in a position several times a day to cover our whole country, potentially, with an EMP field, because they have two satellites orbiting over this country, one called the KMS-3 and the other the KMS-4, at the optimum altitude, if they were nuclear-armed. You don't know if they've got a nuke on them or not, but if one of those satellites, or both of them, are nuclear-armed, they do happen to pass over the ideal location to put an EMP field over all of North America, or most of North America, all 48 contiguous United States, most of Canada, and a good chunk of Mexico. Now, if you were to do a ship-launched EMP using an SA-2 missile, a surface-to-air missile, such as the North Koreans managed to position in the Gulf of Mexico in 2013, this was during, or in the immediate aftermath of what up to that time had been our most serious crisis with North Korea up to that time. The North Koreans had conducted their third illegal test in February of 2013, and that's when Kim Jong-un started threatening that he could strike the United States and destroy the United States. And they had orbited their first satellite just a couple of months before that, obviously in anticipation of this crisis. But toward the tail end of the crisis, we didn't know it at the time, but they managed to get a freighter into the Gulf of Mexico that had SA-2 nuclear-capable missiles on board. We didn't know about this. They came in from the Atlantic side, and it was as if they wanted to see how much they could get away with, to see if they could get back through the Panama Canal to return to North Korea. So they tried to do that. The inspection of the ship, though, the ship was flagged for inspection, not because we knew there were missiles on board, but because this particular freighter had been used for smuggling drugs, small arms, to terrorists in the past. And so it was on the drug inspection list. Hidden under thousands of bags of sugar, they found two SA-2 missile launchers with the missiles mounted on them so they could be launched. Fortunately, they didn't have warheads on them. They didn't have nuclear warheads. But it looks like an exercise might have been performed to see if they could get in our backyard. And just using two missiles like that, they don't have very long range, but they can get up above 30 kilometers. And if they had launched one of those from the Gulf of Mexico and put it anywhere over the eastern part of the United States, that would be enough to take down the eastern grid. And, you know, we can't survive as a society even without the eastern grid. It's the biggest, most important part. We basically have two big grids in this country, the eastern grid, the western grid, and the Texas grid. Most of the population is supported by the eastern grid. All of our, or almost all of our nuclear reactors are on the eastern grid, and 75% of our electricity is generated by the eastern grid. You see, the EMP field would probably be at 30 kilometers, about 600 kilometers in radius. That wouldn't cover the whole eastern grid, but would destroy enough of it so that you would end up having a cascading blackout that would basically be permanent. Think of what happened during the Great Northeast Blackout of 2003. You know, it shows how vulnerable our electric grid is to this cascading failures. The Great Northeast Blackout of 2003 that put 50 million Americans in dark blacked out New York City so that people had to walk home across the Brooklyn Bridge because the subways wouldn't run was all started by a tree branch coming in contact with a high power line in Ohio. And it caused the northeastern United States to black out from that single point failure. Imagine if you had an EMP field 600 kilometers in radius that destroyed electronics within a circle of that size, obviously it would cause an enormously catastrophic and permanent blackout.
Now, would that cascade effect, would that have the ability to cascade into one of the other grids other than just the eastern grid? I mean, are they all kind of tied together? Would one kind of overload the other if it went down?
No, they're physically separated. which is why some smart people in Texas, a Senator Bob Hall, for example, understanding these things and having formerly worked in the U.S. Air Force on EMP, tried to get Texas protected from EMP. For several years in a row, he's introduced legislation. They've got a study going on in Texas, and I've supported that. One of the things people should understand is you're not dependent on the federal government. You know, you can actually protect the state, even if it's part of the Eastern Grid. You know, if you put in the Faraday cages, the surge arresters in the grid in your state, you can keep your state alive even while everything else goes down all around you. So the solution is not necessarily limited to the federal level. Some people think that we'll have a better shot working from the grassroots up at the state level. And some states, Maine, for example, Virginia, Florida, and Arizona, have passed legislation and have done some things. Virginia has probably done the most to protect themselves already from EMP. I'm hoping that other states will follow. If we get a critical mass, enough states doing things, the feds will be dragged along, hopefully. The federal government did pass, one of the accomplishments of the EMP Commission is we did get them to pass a thing back last year called the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act. And it requires the Department of Homeland Security to educate the states on EMP and to help them to launch pilot projects in the states to show you how you can protect the grid and to show how it can be done cost effectively. We've actually got a project going on in Louisiana, which I hope will survive the termination of the EMP Commission, which would pioneer a pathway for all the states to follow, a political and technological pathway for all the states to follow to get themselves protected. But that's where we are. There are solutions to this. I know this has been sounding big and scary, and it should be scary.
Yes, exactly. It is scary.
And people should, but I don't want people to despair. There's no reason for us to be vulnerable. One of the reasons I've dedicated my professional life, as has my colleagues, to this particular issue is there's no excuse for this country to be vulnerable to EMP. This is one of the few existential threats we can take off the table and protect our children and grandchildren from it. And I thought I was naive enough when I started this back in 1995 when I left CIA to start working for Congress that we could fix the problem in a year. We'd pass a bill, fix the problem in a year. And here I am, and I'm an old man, and we still haven't gotten the problem. And it's because it's taken me years to learn that the chief problem is not technical, and it's not the money, it's the politics of EMP.
Mm-hmm.
I've grown old fighting the EMP war, the EMP political war. One other obstacle, we were talking about why hasn't the country been protected, and we talked about the institutional impediments from the industry, from the Department of Defense, from the Department of Homeland Security. Let me just mention two other factors, and then we can move on. Another institutional impediment is the fact that an EMP can be caused by Mother Nature, and it can be caused by man. Because if it can cause by nature, the Department of Defense says, well, this is the Department of Homeland Security's problem. You know, the geomagnetic storm is the big threat, so they should be working on it, not us. And the Department of Homeland Security will say, well, man can cause an EMP threat. North Korea can do an EMP attack. And the damage from a nuclear EMP is worse than a natural EMP. So this should be the Department of Defense's job. So this finger-pointing between the agencies where the threat that threatens everybody belongs to no one, that phenomena has been a major impediment. And the last, and one of the most serious impediments, is corruption in the way in the mainstream liberal news media, which is most of the media in this country, where people get most of their information, there's a corrupt process that's happened has to do, it's not just with carrying with political correctness and doing what the Obama administration did. Obviously, the Obama administration, as I explained earlier, didn't want to do anything with EMP. But there's this other phenomenon that's perhaps even worse that has to do with how people, the so-called experts, make their living in the mainstream media, you know. Nobody ever wants to admit that they don't know, okay?
No.
People make their living, whether they're nonprofits or they want to get as much face time on TV, radio, in the press as possible. And So they will, even when they don't understand and they're not expert on a topic, they'll pretend that they are. And maybe they're, maybe we've gotten to a point where these people, even when they've got a PhD in physics, are so arrogant that they convince themselves that because they've got that PhD in physics that they must be an expert in EMP too, which is not true. You know, a person with a degree in physics is not an expert on EMP. That's not even the right degree. You know, to be a technical expert on EMP, you should have a doctorate in electrical engineering and a specialty in electromagnetic pulse physics. There's only 1,500 people in the whole free world that have got a credential like that. Either that, or you should have been working in your professional life in the Department of Defense or the intelligence community on EMP, you know, which is where I got my expertise. Very few people have that kind of a background. But we are outnumbered. People who are really experts are outnumbered by 100 or 1,000 to 1 by non-experts who are more than glad to pretend that they are experts, and usually they'll, because they don't know about EMP, they assume that it couldn't be a real threat, or that it's science fiction. While we were having this interview, a colleague of mine sent me another article that appeared in the National Interest saying that EMP is a loony threat, that the idea of an EMP weapon is a loony threat, as it's characterized, written by somebody who's a political scientist who doesn't know anything about EMP.
Beautiful. Yeah.
People like Jeffrey Lewis and Joseph Butt, you know, the reporters get used to going back to these guys for answers because they find these guys always seem to have answers for everything. But the reporters themselves are technological and scientific illiterates and not capable of judging whether a person really knows what they're talking about. I mean, this is really malpractice happening on the minds of the American people by their media,
and
you know, where they are having people. Instead of it being EMP, let's change the subject and talk about brain surgery. Let's suppose it's brain surgery. To me, it's just unethical and wrong, you know, when all you are is a political scientist or you're just a physicist and you don't really have expertise on EMP, to pretend that you do is just as bad as if you pretended you were an expert on brain surgery and, you know, and you don't have a medical degree of any kind and have never had any experience in surgery. But you're going to hold forth and pretend that you are an expert in that field.
And they stayed at a Holiday Inn Express.
Yeah. No, yeah. It's, we hear that.
We got to get that in there.
That's the media on pretty much any topic.
Well, you got to get the beautiful people in there, and then you only interview them for 2 minutes, which is why we've decided to dedicate our show to expert people and giving them time to speak, except for the celebrations of capitalism that we have to take every 15 minutes, which would be right now. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes after our little celebration of capitalism. And our guest is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and I hope you'll tap onto the website. I just added the TV documentary that was made on his book called Electronic Armageddon at wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted. Gonna be a long, long time till touchdown brings me round again to find I'm not the man they think I am at home. Oh, no, no, no.
Speaking of Rocket Man. Okay, so Dr. Pry, what are we going to do with North Korea? I mean, this is a huge situation. Now, no one's working on hardening the electrical grid because that's been disbanded.
Well, I remember
North
too.
North Korea's.
Yeah, I mean, they're launching these. You know, I remember there was a
I wasn't asking you. I was asking him.
Well, I know, but I want to bring up your point here.
Okay.
They showed pictures on the news of these last missiles that he launched and the effective range, and they showed these flight patterns of how far these missiles would go. Launched from mainland North Korea, they could reach the West Coast. Well, what if they went into, you know, orbit and flew over the middle of the country and detonated in the upper atmosphere? Is that a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. And the commission has been warning about that. you know, that they don't need to reenter the atmosphere with a reentry vehicle. They could use one of these satellites. They've already demonstrated the capability to orbit satellites over the United States, and we've had two of these satellites orbiting over us.
But could they launch from mainland and send a nuclear weapon over our country from mainland North Korea and detonate in the upper atmosphere?
Yes. Even the intelligence community, which is, and I say even the intelligence community, because, you know, it isn't, even though Mike Pompeo and Dan Coats are respectively the director of CIA and the director of national intelligence, and we've got figureheads at the top of the intelligence community but appointed by President Trump, it is not President Trump's intelligence community. This is still the Obama administration intelligence community that has been loath to acknowledge the North Korean threat, and they have been lowballing the North Korean threat. The EMP Commission has been warning that they've been lowballing this threat for years. You may recall this last summer, most Americans haven't noticed it, but there's been an enormous watershed that happened this past summer. Because going into the summer, a position of the intelligence community and of many so-called experts was North Korea didn't have ICBMs yet, not really. Many people were arguing that the ICBMs they had were fake missiles and that they wouldn't even work. Oh, all right? And then they demonstrated with their launch on the 4th of July that they aren't fake missiles. And indeed, the other part of the argument I would add was that even if they did work, they wouldn't have the range to reach the mainland of the United States, that they could only reach Alaska or Hawaii. And the missile launches from this summer and the most recent missile launch have belied all that. Now, even the Obama administration intelligence community concedes that the North Korean ICBMs can hit anywhere in North America. You know, that they've got the range to do that. And we knew that. We knew that years ago. Because these lofted trajectory flights that they were performing, some of them flew for 40 minutes. 40 minutes, okay? Even though the range they were traveling on the ground was not great, they were traveling on lofted trajectories, high into space, powered flight for 40 minutes. Now, Russian ICBMs only take 30 minutes to reach the United States from Central Asia, and they're further away than North Korea, okay? So if you can fly a missile for 40 minutes in any direction, it's going to be able to reach anywhere in the United States. And they should have known that years ago, but no, they had to wait until North Korea made it so clear that not even they could continue to deny it.
Right.
That,
and, you know, well, another thing they're doing is they're focusing on their ability to hit a city. You know, do they have the technology to really put one in L.A. or Portland?
That's what we're obsessing about.
That's what we're obsessing about. But apparently, it doesn't matter if they can just get it up in the air. They can turn it loose anywhere.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's precisely it. An EMP threat is a much bigger threat. It'll kill. It's the only way of destroying us and winning a nuclear war and destroying us as a civilization. What would you get if you nuked this city, okay? They only have about a dozen ICBMs. You know, we would turn North Korea into a plate of glass if they nuked this city. But if they did an EMP attack, there's a chance we might not be able to retaliate at all. If they, as we suspect, if they've got the super EMP weapon that can generate 100,000 volts per meter on the ground, which is what the North Koreans claim they've got in their technical report, that would paralyze the command. Our military forces, including our ICBMs and our bombers and our command and control assets to talk to our submarines, are only hardened to half that field strength, to 50,000 volts per meter at most. So not only would it enable them to knock out the United States with one weapon, but it could stop us from retaliating, you know, by frying and paralyzing our strategic forces. So it's the only realistic, sensible way for the North Koreans to attack if they were to attack us. This idea of just blasting a city is just a suicidal, right, you know, for them to do that.
Well, I was reading in one of your articles that the reason China and Russia are slow to react to the North Korean threat is they're using them as a proxy. Let this nut go ahead and launch one. They can blame him. They'd be in a perfect position at that point to do pretty much whatever they want if we're basically incapacitated by an EMP.
Well, yes, this is another theme that the Commission had been warning about for many years, because it just seems so obvious to us that the North Korean nuclear missile threat is built on Russian and Chinese technology, and this isn't speculation. We know it. We see it. And even the Obama intelligence community, this data is in front of their eyes, but they don't want to acknowledge it. The Russians sold, a dozen Gulf-class ballistic missile submarines to North Korea, allegedly for scrap, okay? But surprise, surprise, the North Koreans didn't use them for scrap. They started reverse engineering them so that they could figure out how to make their first ballistic missile submarine, the Sinpo 1, which the intelligence community didn't think was possible for them for many years, even for decades. But here they are. They've already got a ballistic missile submarine. They also gave them the SSN-6 missile, which is an intercontinental ballistic missile. And most of the North Korean ICBMs have been based on the Russian SSN-6 technology. The more recent, most successful ICBMs bear striking resemblance to Chinese ICBMs. And we know the TALs, the transporter erector launchers for these ICBMs. This is not an insignificant piece of technology, a transporter erector launcher that can transport an entire ICBM and launch and fire it from, like, the middle of the woods somewhere. An ICBM weighs a tremendous amount. These trucks are enormous. They're mobile firing pads with all the command and control launch technology you need inside the truck. These are not made by North Korea. They're made by China. And even during a parade that they had in Pyongyang displaying their mobile ICBMs, they forgot to scrape the logo off of one of these trucks. The logo for the Chinese factory where it was made.
Oops.
So the Chinese, this is a joke, the idea that the Chinese and Russians were making an enormous foreign policy mistake by going with our head in our hands and asking the Chinese and the Russians to help us against North Korea. North Korea is a pawn in a big geostrategic nuclear chess game. They are playing against us. And every time we do that, it strengthens their hand because it signals to our allies that their security is not dependent on the United States, but is dependent on China and Russia helping the United States. At some point, our allies may decide to switch sides, because they will get better protection from China or Russia via the North. Have you ever noticed that North Korea never threatens to attack China or Russia? Never. Sometimes they get ruffled diplomatic. There's some diplomatic words, but it's the good cop, bad cop kind of play. But they never have made a threat against China or Russia to attack them the way they do against our allies and against the United States themselves. But the object here of Russia and China is to win without war, if possible, but with war, if necessary. What they're hoping to do is raise the stakes so high, because it's a game changer. It changes the geostrategic calculus of risk when our own country is now at risk from North Korea. Our security guarantees to Japan, South Korea, and our other Pacific allies were based on the idea that, we could support them without risk to our own homeland. But now that our homeland is at risk, they're hoping that our Washington elites and the American people themselves will say, is it really worth putting 320 million Americans at risk for the national security of these distant countries who haven't really spent enough on protecting their own national security? Why should we put ourselves at risk when Japan and South Korea have failed to do what was necessary, have failed even to ask for help? And asked us to, stop the North Korean program years ago. Instead, they want us to enter into a mutual assured destruction relationship now with the madman in Pyongyang. Russia and China are hoping that our answer to that question will be, no, this is too risky. You're on your own. We're going to go into a Fortress America isolationist posture. And they're aware that there are many Americans who, both on the left and the right, who feel that way, who feel that the time has come for the United States to withdraw from the world. They want to encourage us to withdraw from the world in the Pacific. And if it happens in the Pacific, and if they are successful there, see Iran going nuclear next. And they'll play the same game out again in the Middle East and Europe with our European allies to try to get us to withdraw from there. They would like to win without war. as Sun Tzu said, the greatest victory is to achieve victory without fighting. And that's what they're trying to do with nuclear weapons. That's what makes nuclear weapons strategic weapons. It's a chess game so that you can win wars without actually fighting them. The way we won the Cold War against the Soviet Union, without fighting a war, because of the success of our nuclear deterrence strategy. They're trying to do the same thing to us now. However, if it's necessary to fight a war, they're willing to do that too, and able to do it through North Korea without taking risks themselves. That's the game. And our failure to let it get to this point has really put us in a situation where we don't have any good choices anymore. The situation is so bad, I really don't think there are any diplomatic solutions. I'm afraid that we're going to keep going down this path of diplomacy, which, in the final analysis, will mean embracing a mutual assured destruction relationship with North Korea's Pyongyang and Kim Jong-un, and that will surely end with millions of Americans dead. You know, Kim Jong-un is one of the worst actors in history, and it's not like the circumstances are the same as they were during the Cold War. And that's a myth that has also come up among these young people, among these 20-somethings, among people who work in the mainstream media, that somehow mutual destruction, assured destruction, worked during the Cold War. I was there at the CIA. If people knew the real story, how many times we came close to blowing it, you know? There was a dozen times that we nearly went over the edge and ended up in a thermonuclear war with the Soviet Union. It was a miracle that we ended up winning the Cold War without it going nuclear. To then ask our children and our grandchildren to go through that again with Kim Jong-un, I mean, it's stressing the patience of God and fate. It will not end successfully. Mad is not a paradigm for survival. It's a paradigm for self-destruction.
Right. Now, you had mentioned in your article also about the ability to strike North Korea successfully, and you talked about the time it would take them to actually fuel and deploy a nuclear weapon relationship to the time it would take us to strike. Let's talk to us a little bit about that.
But we have to take a really quick break before we do that. And just in case, you know, people are wondering, well, how does he know all this stuff? Well, let's see. He was an intelligence officer with the CIA responsible for analyzing Soviet and Russian nuclear strategy, operational plans, military doctrine, threat perceptions, and developing U.S. paradigms for strategic warning. He also served as verification analyst at the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, responsible for assessing Soviet arms control treaty compliance. So I do believe Dr. Pry is an expert there, and not just your usual talking head that you may have been listening to on MSNBC. You shouldn't be listening to them anyway. They're idiots. But this is We the People Radio. You can find us online and all of the credentials and other information and that article about North Korea as well at wethepeopleradio.us. No one will sleep again after they listen to
that. You know what that is, don't you?
What?
The song.
No.
The love theme from Armageddon, the movie.
Oh, I didn't know that. See, that's why we have Bob. He has to tell us what the music means. In case it goes sailing over our heads. The theme song from Armageddon. Well, that's classic and probably should have been the theme song of the whole show. So, we are here with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and I just want to point out that the second article that we have posted that was from December 5th of this year, America's Epitaph May Be Died of Stupidity. I think that's what we should have called. I should just change the name of the show.
Yeah. Killing me with stupidity.
Exactly.
So what is...
I'm not killing you with stupidity.
Well, I know you're
yeah,
not.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Just checking.
In your article, we talked about our ability to launch a strike against them and their inability or lack of intelligence to see it coming without the help of China or Russia. Let's talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I don't even think if we did it right, even China and Russia would be able to give them early warning. My general argument is that Washington, except for President Trump himself, seems to be paralyzed with fear at the idea that if we launch even a limited strike to disarm nuclear North Korea, that Kim Jong-un would, in effect, destroy Seoul or launch an attack on the United States or do something suicidal. And it's possible that he might. It's possible that he might. But I think the historical record supports the opposite point of view, and that if we were to launch a limited surgical strike, you know, using conventional weapons, do it so quick and do it quickly, that so that he would know that it's not an attempt to change the regime, but it's really just a disarming attack against his missiles that pose a threat to the United States and our territories. That he, that even though he's a psychopath, he's not suicidal, and that he wouldn't escalate. And I think that there are some historical precedents to support this. That even his, that even psychopaths like Kim Jong Un are not suicidal and extremists. And not inclined to commit suicide. You know, I think of Hitler and the Führer bunker, for example. You know, even when he knew the Red Army was moving in on him, he was still hoping that he could cut a deal with the Allies. And for that reason, right up until the end, he didn't use Taber and Sirin nerve gases, which Germany had a monopoly on them. We didn't have Taber and Sirin nerve gas, but he would not authorize their use, you know, because he knew that that would ultimately be suicidal and it would banish his last hope to cut some kind of a deal with the Allies. Israel, when it attacked the Assyrian reactor in Iraq and stopped Saddam Hussein's nuclear program, Saddam Hussein, even though he's a psychopath and just like Kim Jong-un, he did not retaliate against Israel. He knew that that if he did so, it would be the end of him, that the Israelis, Mossad, would find a way to knock him off. And so he tolerated the limited strike. It didn't overthrow his regime, but it stopped him from getting nuclear weapons. It happened again in Syria with Hafez al-Assad, where the North Koreans were building basically a nuclear bomb factory in Syria for Assad. And the Israelis launched a successful limited strike there, and Assad did not retaliate for it. During the Persian Gulf Wars, both of them, Saddam Hussein did not use nuclear weapons against the U.S. troops because he knew that would be a suicidal act. And this is called intra-war deterrence. So there are, we have some substantial precedents that even dealing with psychopathic, evil people, that if that they will take it. They will be, they are prudent enough that they will not commit a suicidal act. And that's what it would be if Kim Jong-un decided to launch chemical and biological or even a nuclear attack on Seoul or launch a nuclear attack on one of our allies or the United States itself in response to a very limited attack that just took out his 12 ICBMs, his intermediate range ballistic missiles, maybe take out his Yongbyon, his one known above-ground nuclear facility. In my attack, I recommend starting with the satellites that pose a clear and present danger to the United States, that we could just take out the satellites and then have a pause, a diplomatic pause for a possible diplomatic solution. I don't believe any diplomatic solution is going to be possible at this point, just through negotiations. The United States has got to demonstrate that the red line has been crossed and that we are willing to defend ourselves with some military act. At minimum, we should take out those satellites. I have a more ambitious attack plan, limited attack plan for disarming the rest of his nuclear arsenal that goes beyond that. But that's basically the theme. And we could do it because right now he's only got 13 ICBMs. He's got maybe 30 to 60 intermediate range ballistic missiles. You know, it would only take us a few hours with a couple of three aircraft carrier groups, I calculate, to be able to take out those assets. His missiles are also liquid fueled. It takes, they're not solid fueled missiles that can be launched at any moment. You know, it takes at least 90 minutes. Probably several hours to fuel up the missiles for use. And he doesn't have long-range ballistic missile early warning radars or any kind of a technical intelligence apparatus that would give him early warning, you know, so we would be able to be upon him.
Do you think Russia and China, who do have those capabilities, would step in and say, hey, they're coming? Do you think that's a possibility?
I think that that's a possibility for them misinforming him, which is another reason to take them out, because I think that that's why North Korea is a threat to us, not just because of Kim Jong-un, but maybe even more so from Russia and China, that if they decided to launch a nuclear war against us, that they wouldn't do it directly. They could do it indirectly through him by misinforming him. Now, I don't think that they would see us coming either if we did it off of aircraft carrier groups, if we exercised the appropriate communication security and the like. I think we'd be able to do it in a few hours, and it would be like lightning and over before they could even do anything. So that's why I think we would be able to get away with it. At the minimum, it would buy us time, you know, so that we'd roll the threat back. It'd still have short-range and medium-range ballistic missiles that are nuclear-armed that would be able to threaten, you know, Japan and South Korea, which is another reason why he wouldn't retaliate in a suicidal way. But at least it would roll it back so that the threat to the United States homeland itself, to the American people, and to our U.S. territories would be rolled back and give us time to either come up with a more complete military solution or regime change, or maybe finally, if we were to exercise our muscles, right, our military muscles, maybe that would finally convince Russia, China, North Korea that the United States is serious enough under this president that they need to back off, that we need to have a negotiated solution. For sure, we're not going to have a solution if we don't act militarily. And the idea that doing nothing is the best policy, I think, will end in disaster. You know, because I think mutual assured destruction with North Korea will, in the end of the day, be exactly that. You know, Kim Jong-un is Caligula armed with nuclear weapons. And either through design or miscalculation someday, he will use those against us. As we move in toward the last 12 minutes of the show, you've commented a couple of times on how this is not exactly consistent with the Christmas themes of the season, okay?
but you know, it's not inconsistent because we're finishing up the first year of President Trump's term. We've had a lot of people with a lot of ideas who are unhappy with a variety of things, and one of the prevailing...
Well, let me try to make it a little, to end on a note, or bring us toward the closure on a note.
Okay, we have to have one more brief celebration of capitalism here. Thank our advertisers. It's a bad time of year to shoot the advertisers in the back. And then we'll be right back with Dr. Peter Pry. I guess I shouldn't talk about shooting anyone in the back, huh? Get me in a lot of trouble.
Bad form.
Bad form. All right, we'll be right back. You can find all the information about the program and the archive after the show ends at wethepeopleradio.us.
I blame you for the moonlit sky and the dream that died with the eagle's flight. I blame you for the moonlit nights when I wonder why are the seas still dry. Don't blame. While the air raid sirens blare, it's Christmas at Ground Zero. The button has been pressed. The radio just let us know that this is not a test. Everywhere the atom bombs are dropping, it's the end of all humanity. No more time for last minute shopping, it's time to face your final destiny. It's Christmas at Ground Zero. There's panic.
Yeah, I had to go there, Bob.
We can dodge
serious
the
about this.
The tree.
Oh my gosh. Well, just when you think there couldn't be a perfect song for this at Christmas time, well, you've got Weird Al. Dr. Pry, go ahead and try to top that here to the top of the hour. And you know, can you let us know what people can do? You know, how can we put some pressure and maybe help you guys get back in the driver's seat and get the EMP commission going again?
Well, in the last eight minutes, let me add something that's kind of a Christmas thought, though not a cheery one. But on the other hand, Christianity and it's not always about celebration and merriment. As your as one of your advertisers in the break mentioned, how our society, you know, is based on the Judeo-Christian tradition, and here as we celebrate Christmas, you know, we sell one of the icons of Christmas is the Christmas Star of Bethlehem that gave birth to the Prince of Peace. All right. The confrontation we have with North Korea right now is something, I think, really unprecedented. It's almost out of the Old Testament. And to just give you one illustration about why coexistence with North Korea and Kim Jong-un isn't going to work, I contrast, here's one fact I would like to mention. Okay, I mentioned the Star of Bethlehem, the sign of the birth of the Prince of Peace, all right? Those satellites that are orbiting over the United States are named the Kwangmyong-Song 3 and Kwangmyong-Song 4. And the liberal mainstream media translates this as meaning bright star or lodestar. But actually, I think it's out of ignorance. They're not really giving the full history of the significance of those names. In North Korean mythology, the birth of the North Korean nation and people happened with a conqueror who was born on Mount Paeku under a star called the Kwangmyong Song. It was the star of a conqueror, okay? And there might have been some historical reality to him. We believe that he drove Han China out of the Korean Peninsula and created the basis for North Korean civilization. All of the Kims, Kim Jong-un's grandfather, his father, and Kim Jong-un himself, according to official state media, have been born under that star. That star has reappeared, and they have been born on Mount Paeku. They are supposed to be the embodiment, the actual, if not spiritual, rebirth of this conqueror. And so these satellites that are named for that evil star, as it were, I think alone signify to us the grave danger we are in right now, and in thinking about trying to coexist with such a monstrosity as a Kim Jong-un, who is the antithesis of everything that the Judeo-Christian society represents. If you just look at his tyranny, it's written even on the bodies of his people, who are smaller in stature, who weigh less, not to mention their spirits and their minds and what's been done to them. Dare we put ourselves at risk by trying to coexist with such a society? Is it even a morally and ethically right thing to conceive of going along and getting along and tolerating such a thing? I would remind people to think of the Civil War, what Abraham Lincoln said about the Civil War in his second inaugural address, about how he believed the Civil War was actually a punishment from God for having tolerated slavery. So with that, not exactly cheery thought, but certainly one that I think the Prince of Peace would like us all to contemplate, about whether, even if we could buy our own survival at the price of coexistence with someone like Kim Jong-un, should we? Is that the path we want to follow and should follow if we believe in freedom for all men?
No, you're...
Well, every day we don't do something about this, we literally are rolling the dice.
Yes, exactly. And so even if you don't believe in God, okay, and if you're an atheist, there tends to be a practical price one pays for the ethical choices one makes in life. As we learned bitterly from World War II, when people didn't listen to the Winston Churchills, but listened to the Neville Chamberlains and tried to coexist with Adolf Hitler, and the price was 50 million dead in World War II. But what can we do? I see we've got 3 minutes now.
No pressure.
I would encourage all listeners, you know, to call, write, tell their member of Congress, their senator, or congressman to join the Congressional EMP caucus, to join the Congressional EMP caucus, to try to pass legislation that would to solve this problem for the country. Write, call, tweet President Trump. Remind President Trump that it's in the Republican Party platform on which he was elected that we're supposed to protect the electric grid. It's in the Republican Party platform. It's one of the promises he made. How is that promise fulfilled? By letting the EMP commission be terminated. Maybe the president should intervene and set up a presidential commission under his direction that would protect this country and get it away from the politics of the Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security, which are still dominated, really, by Obama holdovers. Don't look just to the federal government. Follow your state representative and your state governor, wherever you live, that you want to get your state protected against EMP. Form a state task force to look into this about how you can do it. Reach out to my task force, the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. We are willing to work with the states to provide the expertise for free, you know, to try to get your state protected. And last but not least, we are all our own first line of defense. Be prepared to protect your family. If you can protect yourself, you can also help your neighbors. You'll be in a position to do that. You know, have a food supply, have a water supply, have a plan to protect your family if the lights go out, have a medicine kit, know how to use it. Preparedness for this is just like preparedness for a hurricane or a tornado, except on a more protracted level. And you won't be living in fear. I think it will make you happier, as my parents were happier, being prepared for anything. You know, it was part of the great American tradition to be prepared for anything, right up until a generation or two ago. My mother and father, who lived through the Great Depression and World War II, they'd never heard of EMP, but they were ready for anything. We lived on a quarter of an acre. It was farmed. My mother was canning and storing food all the time. My father taught us how to hunt and fish, not just for recreation, but that's how he fed his family through the Great Depression. And they were happy people, because they knew they could protect their own and they could take care of their family. Those are American values that are kind of unique to us, this belief in rugged individualism and self-sufficiency and not trusting that the government is always going to be there to bail you out and expecting the government to play that role. I really think our constitutional republic was designed for people like that. And if we recaptured those great American values, those pioneering values that made America great and free, it would be good for all of us, and I think we would not be living in fear, but be living happier lives when we can thumb our noses at the Kim Jong-uns of the world.
That's,
amen to that.
Words to live by.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Peter Pry, thank you for coming on. We got to have you on again. We got so much more to talk about.
Thank you so much for having me. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Absolutely. Thank you all for joining us. You've been listening to We the People. Please join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.